It's really about if 70% of your initiatives are failing, that's actually money down the drain. So in terms of valuation and growth, isn't it in your best interest to actually do what it takes up front to make sure that the needle is moved on that 70%, to make sure that the needle is moved on that 70%?
This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nessel & Associates, Dr. Jack Nessel.
Hello, everyone. Jack here. In this episode, we're going to explore the vital intersections of PMO, IT governance, and the dynamic world of mergers and acquisitions. This episode is loaded with value for investment firm leaders, strategic planners, and anyone keen on understanding the nuances of driving successful organizational change in a competitive environment. You'll gain insights into the best practices of PMO implementation, the role of IT in transformative mergers, and how to navigate the often complexities of corporate change. Whether you're an executive, a project manager, or a stakeholder in the investment community, this episode is designed to provide you with valuable knowledge to enhance your strategic approach. And to guide us through this journey, we have an exceptional guest with us today, Jen Scrabag. Jen is a renowned figure in the field, recognized as a LinkedIn top voice four times over. She brings a wealth of experience from her roles as a PMO executive, where she has designed and led PMOs from prominent organizations like Oracle, Teradata, and Anthem, including a Fortune 5 company. Her expertise spans strategic planning, organizational change management, and operational excellence. And with over 18 years of professional experience, certifications in PRESAI and Agile methodologies, and a history of leading high-profile digital transformation programs, Jen's insights are valuable to anyone looking to excel in this domain. And let's not forget her contribution as an author and a professional speaker, where she has shared her knowledge on PMO, leadership skills, and program management. From Southern California, Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jack. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, Jen, before we dive into today's conversations, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey and experiences. So if you could further introduce yourself to our listeners and perhaps share some insights and highlights from your career, that would be appreciated.
Absolutely. I'm excited to share my journey due to the key pivots I made, and those were to take advantage of different opportunities while discovering my passion for strategy and PMOs. And if you don't know already, PMO stands for Program or Portfolio Management Offices, which is depending on the organization's focus. I began my journey in IT, and to be honest, I was an accidental project manager. I was at William Morris, and that is the talent agency in Beverly Hills. And to give some background, William Morris was one of the first companies that adopted Next Computers. And if Next Computers and technology sounds familiar, that was when Steve Jobs left Apple for the first time. Yeah. Down to Next. Well, 7 to 8 years later, the hardware and the software were obsolete and failing at William Morris. So the big project at that time was to migrate all of the hardware, the software, yes, the data, and also the people onto the new systems and processes. And if you've ever watched TV or know talent agents, you know they are highly demanding and expect perfection. So that was a project I implemented for the first time, as I mentioned, as an accidental project manager. It was challenging, but the most important thing that I discovered was I had a passion for project management. And the one thing I really enjoyed about project management and that particular project overall was that it was the role closest to the CEO, where if you think about it, you're held accountable for the project end to end, and you're empowered to deliver that end to end. And you have absolute say and authority over human resources, the budget, strategic direction, and stakeholders, as long as you deliver. So it's truly everything a CEO would do and manage overall. And as I progressed through the ranks in my career from project program to portfolio manager to building and leading PMOs, which range from 10 million all the way upwards to 500 million. It rivaled the responsibility of a CEO for some of the world's largest and most successful organizations in tech and healthcare. So first and foremost, I consider myself as a practitioner, but then also a Fortune 500 executive, expert, and author in project program and portfolio management strategy and PMOs.
Well, thank you, Jen. What a great story and experience, for sure. I'm so excited to have you on the show to share some of your insight. Certainly, your extensive background in setting up and leading PMOs for major organizations, coupled with your expertise in strategic planning and organizational change management, no doubt means you have a wealth of knowledge in navigating complex transformations. Your insights will undoubtedly be valuable to our listeners, especially those involved in similar initiatives in their organizations. Listeners, all of us here at the ERP OCJ hope you find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, discover best practices, and explore the human element components of ERP organizational change. And stay with us till the end. Jen will give us her actionable gold nugget of advice based on today's conversation, and I will recap today's key discoveries and offer my suggestions on how to implement what we've learned. Our conversations here at the ERP OCJ are built around the listen and learn approach. It's when you apply what you've learned that you begin to move the needle forward. So let's dive in. So Jen, considering your deep experience in PMO and strategic planning, what key strategies should investment firms adopt to effectively navigate organizational change?
I think there are two that comes to mind. One thing is we take a step back and think about change management models that are widely used out there. There's ProSize, ACT-CAR, there's Cotter's 8-step and all of that. That's all important, but I think the fundamental thing is to build overall project management into the change management or vice versa. So integrated, so it's a seamless process overall. I think of change management as a critical work stream and overall how the project is being executed and delivered. So I think that's the first thing to do is to integrate that overall. The second thing, and this is the hardest thing, but the most critical thing, is to build true ownership and accountability into the change. It's not just a sponsor on paper, but it's a person that truly owns the business results of the change, good or bad. And I think of it as, other than the CEO, do you have someone in your organization who can hold other leaders accountable? And that's exactly the role I played as a PMO leader. So it wasn't just a seat at the table, but it's actually driving that accountability throughout the organization.
Great advice. So how then, how do you identify and mitigate common strategic planning pitfalls that could impact a firm's growth potential?
My favorite quote around this concept is, strategy without execution is hallucination. That's a quote that's attributed to Thomas Edison. And what that means is that it's not just the big idea or the vision or the quantity of ideas, but actually how to turn that into a tactical plan that's delivered. Mm-hmm. And the key with strategic planning that many organizations don't do well is to actually vet the business case proposals cross-functionally and ensure that it's the best one that we're going forward with, not just the good ones, not just it looks like it's a good idea. And I highlight the word best because it's not just something that is a good idea to do, but when you line it up with all of the other good ideas across the organization, it's the one that's truly best, ready to go, ready to execute because you have a plan in place and you do have the resources, and that will give you the best overall return. The second thing is think of it as if you're a CEO and you want funding for your organization, for your company that you're starting up, you have to put together a fairly well thought out, concise business case that is compelling. Why not do that at the organizational level with all of the project proposals that the leaders want to do? Have you put together a process to do that? It does not have to be an overly cumbersome process, but think about it as a Shark Tank pitch. Do you have your leaders come to the table with those business case proposals, have a concise pitch, and then make decisions cross-functionally? The other way to think about this is that the number one cause of projects failing And keep in mind that the project failure rate is still something like 70%. And so it's been that way for the last 50 or 60 years since it's been tracked and reported that the project failure rate is still 70%. Are you looking at the scarce capital dollars and also the human resources that are being invested and then making those intentional choices as to which of those good ideas will be able to give you the largest return? And the way I think about it, and I put together a very simple but compelling framework that I'm going to call strategize your portfolio. If you take a look at all the investments you're making in your organization, so it is projects and it's also to some extent operations, divided into four quadrants or four categories. On the x-axis, you can have low to high risk and then low to high value, and that will go on your y-axis. And then the quadrants are these, and these are broadly how you can allocate your organization's investment dollars internally into these four categories. The first category is keep the lights on or operations or maintenance. And ideally, that should be a minimal part of your investment. Maybe it's 10 or 20%. But initially, you will want to baseline and see where it lands for your organization because it might be as high as 40, 50, even 60%. The second category I'm going to call the product roadmap. These are ongoing enhancements to your existing products. You'll want to maintain those. Sometimes they're called bread and butter. The third category is what I call large platform. These are your digital transformations. These are your ERP investments. You do want to intentionally allocate for these. These are higher risk and lower value initially, but they actually are the foundation and the infrastructure for where you're going to go in your business for the next 3, 5, 10 years from now. So you'll want to intentionally invest in that as well. And then the fourth category is the true innovation, the R&D. These are truly things that have never been done before. As an example, when Netflix embarked on being essentially a content provider, a movie and TV studio, they had some investments in R&D for that while they were maintaining their shipping DVDs through the mail business, which was their bread and butter and their foundational business. So these four categories are things that you want to intentionally invest in and then allocate accordingly to your strategy. So what does that mean? If you are intentionally investing in a lot of R&D and your large platform, you're going to have to make room for that or reallocate from potentially your keep the lights on or your product roadmap. These are intentional decisions and not accidental. I think that's actually one of the keys to mitigate the strategic planning pitfalls. It's not just having the idea. It's not even just having a good idea, but it's actually intentionally selecting the ideas that will go forward, you know, be able to deliver and execute on. So it's not hallucination.
Yeah, that's good stuff, Jen. I appreciate it. You know, the idea of concept, idea, and goals to moving that to strategy and then moving that to tactical project management and getting down to the brass tacks that properly support the strategy, I think is critical. That alignment between those three levels, right? And I liked how you mentioned, you know, 70% of projects fail. And how much of that do you believe is due to not being realistic and honest about any given project, thereby creating project fallacy? You know, as you alluded to, Jen, you mentioned the idea of communication being a key to success. What do you think about that? Is a lot of that failure is obviously you got poor strategy, maybe it's a bad idea to begin with, and then you also have just bad tactical approach to accomplishing that mission. But how much of that do you think is also just not being aligned in terms of the realities and just being honest about the endeavor that the organization is about to take on?
In my opinion, a large percentage of that is not being aligned internally and also not being realistic. Number one cause of failures for project is the lack of resources. So I spend some time up front to make sure it's correctly resourced. That's why I mentioned it's ready to go. It's ready to execute. Yeah. It's not so much a good idea, but someone has a plan with the corresponding resources. And keep in mind, when I mention resources, there's two types of resources. There's the human resources, absolutely. There's also the financial resources or your budget. And then with human resources, there's capacity. So do you have the sheer number of people in your organization? But then there's also capability or skill sets. And we've evolved in terms of being a primarily operational, I think. Maybe if you look back 20 years ago, maybe in an organization, it was 80% operations and potentially 20% project to nowadays, I believe it's 80% projects and 20% operations. Why is that? Well, I think there's certain trends that's happening in the future of work, which is actually happening now. And those are things like skill-based roles, where in the past, maybe we had a certain job title, whether it's project manager or change manager or something else. And we had a list of things that we did. Maybe it was daily, maybe it was weekly, monthly, and we just executed on that. Nowadays, with the advent of it's not just AI, but yes, AI and all of the digital transformation initiatives, things are rapidly changing. And we do have to have not only the technical skills, the project management skills, but also the business domain knowledge in order to effectively execute. So that's where I mean by it's not only capacity, it's also the capability. And the skills are rapidly changing. It's estimated something like 65% of the job skills will change by the year 2030. That's only 6 years from now. So imagine that.
So Jen, speaking of business domain knowledge, and in your previous response, you'd mentioned the idea of the CEO and investment alignment and strategy. This is more of a general question, but can you discuss the impact of effective change management on the growth and valuation of investment-centric organizations?
Yes, I think of change management as really the enabler of how we implement change. And all change is implemented through projects. So it's really about if 70% of your initiatives are failing, that's actually money down the drain. So in terms of valuation and growth, isn't it in your best interest to actually do what it takes up front to make sure that the needle is moved on that 70%? And I would challenge people to measure where they're at today with their project success rates. So that 70% is very broad, and obviously it's a statistic out there and it's been touted for decades. But what is it in your organization in terms of the project success rate? And really focus on the most critical ones, the ones that are truly transformational, that's going to give you the growth, that's going to grow your revenue or make your company more efficient. Focus on that, measure it. And then think about what does it take to move the needle on it? I would propose that it's number one, resources. It's always resources. And so do the planning up front. And I have a very simple resource planning technique that I use to just vet out those business case proposals. Because again, it's not just, is it a good idea? It's about, can it be executed? And do we have the capacity and capability to execute that? The second thing about change is that we have to remember change starts with all of us. So it's one thing to follow all of the change management models, and I see those being executed. It's almost like a fill out the template, check the box. You know, let's ensure the messaging is out there. Let's ensure that we have training and support. All of that is super critical and important. But at the end of the day, I think it's about, if we want to do transformation and we want to make sure our change is successful and our change is being adopted effectively, how can we improve the process, not just do a lift and shift, but actually improve the process, make it better? So if it's an internal project to end users, is it a better experience for them overall once we implement the change? If it's an external project to end customers, is it something that we actually have improved in terms of that customer experience? That actually, to me, is effective change management. And then ultimately, that drives the growth and valuation going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Good insight. So, Jen, Nestle and Associates supports a great deal of mergers and acquisitions. And in your approach to PMO setup and strategic planning, what unique considerations come into play for firms with a strong focus on growth through acquisition and expansion specifically?
Well, I think the first thing is to think about, are you balancing your operational work and intentionally allocating to that versus all of the project work. So the project work in those three categories that I mentioned, which includes the innovation, your product roadmap, and your large platform migrations or implementations. And the reason I say this is that what I see is that the work and the teams that are necessary to do the operational work is fundamentally different than the transformational work. And if you don't intentionally allocate and build your A team for the transformational work, that's where I think a lot of those initiatives do fail, because we're taking operational people who are great and they're absolutely needed to maintain the current operations, to maintain the current projects, versus the people that are needed to do transformation are the A team. And you need to intentionally build your A team, set aside those dedicated resources, and then empower them to execute through an organization like a PMO. And I say like a PMO, whether you call it a PMO or not, and it really depends on the organization. Do you have someone that is full-time, dedicated, focused, and I emphasize full-time and dedicated, to ensuring that projects are being executed on time, on budget, on scope, but then most importantly, delivers the value that it was intended? And I think that's actually the biggest pitfall when we have large mergers and acquisitions that happen, is that we think just by designating an operational person, so it can be an operational leader, let's just say the CIO or the CFO or the chief product officer, there's a number of those people that can be designated, but their role is not a full-time dedicated role to ensuring that these transformational initiatives are being executed.
Yeah. Jen, I would like to switch gears to a few questions regarding IT, ERP, and digital transformation specifically. And so I guess my first question in that regards is, from your experience, what are the crucial elements for integrating IT and ERP systems during transformational ventures?
Yes, I've been through actually a very large SAP initiative that was implemented in 33 months, unheard of, all of HR, finance, supply chain, and manufacturing. And I was part of the leadership team that enabled that. So I got to see from the ground up what it takes, and there was a lot it took, but what were also some of the best practices that allowed us to do that? Because there are horror stories out there around ERP implementations and IT transformation in general. So the first thing is, from my experience, the number one thing to do is be willing to adopt new processes based on the best practices that's already built into the system, versus hanging on or just migrating your legacy processes over. Because the fastest and the smoothest ERP implementation and IT transformation in general was one that we adopted what I call vanilla processes, vanilla approach. Basically, try to use it out of the box. A lot of these platforms, whether it's ERP or if you look at IT transformation in general, a lot of these platforms are built that it's highly configurable. So it's highly configurable. However, look at simplifying what you have first before migrating over. I'll give you one example of product SKUs. And this is actually a very enlightening example where if you look at organizations and their product SKUs and their part SKUs, it's typically a mess. And you might think, well, that's just a small thing. Why do we care about that? Or product SKUs impact how you sell. It impacts how you price. It also impacts ultimately, of course, your revenue. And if you don't take the effort upfront to simplify something as critical as that, but also as you might think of it as a small piece of the puzzle as that, you're not. It will impact your ability to sell. So in one organization that I was a PMO leader on, they had legacy processes from when they were primarily a hardware focused company to they went through a transformation and then sold themselves as a software focused company. And this is a $2 billion company, so not a small company by any means. Well, their processes, their master data, their product SKUs were based on the fact that they were a hardware company. So their product SKUs reflected the fact that they were a hardware-based company. This is how they priced. This is how they sold. This is how they manufactured their products, was based on the hardware. Well, after going through this transformation to a software-based company, they had problems in selling the products because now they were trying to sell software as a reoccurring subscription model. And if you were a hardware-based company with hardware SKUs and you haven't changed those yet, you haven't truly migrated those over into new processes, that's where the stumbling block is. So the short answer is that simplify your process, go vanilla, and then also take a look at fundamentally the small things that make a huge difference. Things like product SKUs, because that affects how you price, sell, manufacture, and ultimately distribute your product.
I like that, Jen. That was a great example. I appreciate that. You know, accurate and timely data is crucial. I mean, clearly, but adapting new processes and disciplines, even if simplified, which means change, can take time. So how do you balance operational continuity with large-scale digital transformations in rapidly growing or merging entities? You know, we see that a lot in our world, you know, in the merger and acquisition, the private equity world. You know, it's very typical to be in an environment that's just quite rapidly growing, you know, with a lot of mergers and acquisitions. But how do you balance that operational continuity with the large scale digital transformations or ERP transformations or implementations?
I think the best analogy that I heard is to allocate the team to maintain your old jalopy while you're building your new Ferrari. So what does that mean? Yes, you want to ensure operational continuity, but set aside and allocate a separate team to do that. And hopefully it's a minimal team because you really want to focus on moving the needle forward on the innovation, on the digital transformation, on the ERP, which is the largest of any organization that I've been at. ERP is always the largest investment that you have to make as an organization in order to grow and thrive in the next 3 to 5, 10 years. It's not something that you want to just do from a side of the desk type of a model, but you want to really invest in that. And the only way to invest in that is to set aside a dedicated team to do that. Yeah. I have a 3S model that I go by when I assess, well, what's necessary to start. So a lot of times we only focus on the start. Where should we start as a new initiative or new project? But we don't think about what should we stop and then what should we minimally sustain. But if you start thinking about your operational continuity, do you just start items or are you intentionally stopping or just making a decision to sustain? Same thing with your large scale digital transformations. Are you just starting or do you make intentional decisions to stop or sustain? If you take a internal portfolio approach on rationalizing all those investments, I think that will give you more of a holistic picture that you can really set aside the right investment in terms of human resources, in terms of financial resources, on things like building your new Ferrari, which is your ERP or digital transformation.
That's good. And certainly, Jen, you know, this idea that you mentioned of having checks and balances and business intelligence, what we call quote unquote insurance, it needs to be a part of your game plan with intent. You know, so part of this, you know, when you're talking about large transformational change, you know, whether it's IT or certainly ERP and this idea of operational continuity, the idea, you know, that you shared with the deliberate team that is focused on that idea, I think is incredibly valuable and important insight. You know, there's no magic wands or perfection when you go live and there will always be a productivity dip. It's a natural and proven part of such a large scale ERP change project. And so I think just being very diligent about understanding that and having the mechanisms in place to, you know, to what extent you may or may not need that plan depends on how well you plan throughout your implementation process to begin with. But just the idea, like, you know, as you illustrated, the example of having a team dedicated to ensuring operational continuity, I think is incredibly insightful. So thank you for that. Well, let me piggyback off that question, Jen. And in the context of transformational ventures, what role does IT governance play in ensuring successful outcomes? And maybe Jen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but maybe think about it in terms of IT or ERP governance, right? So for me, when you say, you know, develop a dedicated team to ensure operational continuity, for me, that's a bit of not only insurance, but it's kind of a form of ERP governance, right? So in the context of transformational ventures, what role does IT governance play in ensuring successful outcomes?
Yes, as the chair and lead author for PMI's governance practice guide, I happen to know a thing or two about governance, but let me kind of just simplify everything that's in the practice guide into the fact that governance really plays four main functions. One is oversight, the second is control, the third is decision-making, and the fourth is integration. So when I think of governance, and a lot of people are confused about the word governance, what does that mean really? Is it a committee that gets together and meets, or are we reviewing certain things? So think of the oversight one as it's not just status reports. It really should be more of a T-based exception management model. So what I mean by that is if you're getting data that says a project is green, well, that's something that you don't need to focus on, because my expectation as the PMO, and I think every leader should have this expectation, is that projects should be green. We had a plan, we're executing to the plan. What we do need to focus on are the things that are in red or yellow, and then really drill down to the root cause and say, what are we doing about it? And who needs help? And what do I need to do to get that to green? So it's not just the project manager that's responsible for doing that, but as leaders, as part of the overall governance team, we're all collectively responsible for driving that particular project into green. The second thing is around control. So control means that when thresholds are exceeded, and I like to use maybe a 5 to 10% threshold, and you could put these thresholds on things like budget, you could put them on resources, definitely scope comes into the picture, but also the value. So when you put these thresholds on that, and keep in mind the 5 or 10% also empowers the team to solve some of these problems by themselves too, because that gives them some leeway to adjust as needed. But then the most important thing is that's your early warning indicator. You don't need to wait all the way at the end when the project has been delivered to say, whoops, this project failed. They didn't deliver not only on time, on budget, on scope, but they actually didn't deliver the value. So put in these thresholds, and then that's your control function for the governance team. So again, your overall governance team should be collectively responsible for monitoring these and then also actioning these items.
Yep.
The third thing is around decision-making. So I mentioned my 3 S, start, stop, and sustain. I truly believe the reason we have resource issues, as an example, is that we're starting too many projects. We're starting too many initiatives. We haven't intentionally stopped anything. And that's where you get teams that are overworked and overwhelmed. And then they, of course, burn out. And then that further compounds the problem of not delivering. And then the fourth item is around integration. That's actually a critical function of governance that sometimes we don't think about. But that's ensuring the cross-functional impacts, aka dependencies, are known, they're assessed, and then they're planned for. So there's a part of governance that's actually very active in terms of that cross-functional alignment and then impact analysis.
That is good. So Jen, if I were to summarize your response there, I would say that when it comes to IT governance, it's not just reports and red, yellow, green checkboxes and graphs. It's about effective and proactive exception modeling, threshold control, and appropriate decision making. And I really do like your last point as well, because I do think it's a point that's often missed, and that is the idea of integration and understanding the dependencies amongst the different stakeholder groups. Did I paraphrase that in a way that does your response justice?
Yes, you did. You summarized it perfectly, Jack.
So then what best practices can you recommend for achieving seamless integration and enhanced value in mergers and acquisitions?
Yes. So I actually have some key advice around this. The first thing is plan and start the integration day one. It's not something that you should put off. all of the companies that I've been an executive at, and some of them had tremendous organic growth, something like 25% year over year. But also they grew a lot through mergers and acquisition. As you know, healthcare is very fragmented, and all of the companies I worked with have gone through tremendous consolidation over the last 10 years. And they continue to go through that because healthcare is not only extremely fragmented, but it's also extremely disruptive. If you think about the regulatory environment, if you think about the data environment and the privacy concerns. So it's extremely, it's a industry that's extremely transformative and also undergoing transformation. So let me give you an example around this. One very well-known large healthcare company acquired a multi-billion dollar Medicare business that operated in multiple states, but they did not spend any time or resources in integration. And by integration, I mean truly migrating processes, data, systems over, but not a lift and shift. We're really rationalizing what makes sense going forward. How can we align this? And it's always, it's not necessarily always adopting the corporate strategy. It can be adopting a brand new process, brand new system, brand new data. Well, they spent no time on integrating this significant Medicare business into their overall core business. And 4 years later, guess what happened? They were sanctioned by the CMS. So CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medi-Cal, essentially the government agency that oversees all of the seniors business, which is the Medicare business, because of substantial failures in their processes and systems. So all of a sudden, this $4 billion business that they acquired and left alone for 4 years because the perception was that it was going well, it was generating revenue, so why not? Why spend the time on integration of their processes and systems versus just letting it run itself? Well, these sanctions meant that they couldn't sell or market their product to customers until those issues are fixed. I was part of the PMO that was brought in, so part of the overall leading the overall team that was brought in to fix this. And I can tell you the team worked day and night over 2 years to fix those business processes and systems. And the bottom line here is also that I don't know if they fully recovered. Because just last year, I read in the news that they were considering divesting their Medicare business, which is a complete 360 from acquiring this Medicare business years ago, because they never fully integrated it. And if you talk to any of the leaders there during the sanction period, which is extremely stressful, as you can imagine, for everybody that was involved, if you talk to any of the leaders in the organization, they will say that their number one regret is not integrating the systems and processes on day one, that they just left it alone, they let it go, and then now they had to deal with the sanctions, remediating the sanctions, trying to get it back on track. And again, I don't believe they fully recovered from that. So the biggest lesson here is make the investment upfront to assess and integrate the business process and system to what it should be. Don't just leave it running by itself.
Oh, Jen, that's a great example. And frankly, that's a topic that gives me goosebumps and we could discuss for hours. The idea of data consolidation into one ERP platform is common during mergers and acquisitions. And we have provided a great deal of guidance over the years for many, many projects that have fallen short in that exact area. And we currently have, you know, multiple projects where we're supporting clients with this. And, you know, as you said, Jen, I mean, plan day one, especially with data integration, mapping, validation, and so forth. I mean, you've probably heard the phrase that it's the longest pole in the tent. So the idea of starting, you know, if you have a project kickoff today, then that means tomorrow, 8 a.m., you're starting your process of data migration. So I think that was great. Listening to you talk about that experience is something that we see often, unfortunately. And Jen, I would say from a PM tactical perspective, you know, again, so that's a common concern, and it's a heavy lift sometimes. And especially if you have, you know, if an organization has bang, 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 you know, multiple acquisitions in a short period of time, and their goal is to strategically bring all of the platforms into one, you know, one common platform, you know, that's a pretty important item that that you don't want to miss. So great example.
Absolutely. I actually share your approach to starting the integration on day one. I think it's a investment that really pays off at the end of the day. You don't want to wait until you have to do it or you're forced to do it. You want to make sure that you're planning for it and you're intentionally embarking on that journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jen, I would like to maybe talk about, I have a couple of questions, and I guess I would categorize these under the maximizing returns with strategic IT and ERP management. So given your background with top-tier clients, what strategy should growth-oriented firms implement for effective IT and ERP management to enhance returns? So I know that's a bit of a general and loaded question, but yeah, given your background, what strategies would you recommend that growth-oriented PE firms should implement for effective IT and ERP management?
Sure. I think of three things. And the first is go vanilla. So that just means simplify your processes. Try to adopt the processes that's already inherently built into a lot of these systems. So ERP, a lot of the other systems and platforms do have a lot of inherent business processes. Try to understand it and just adopt it. That's what I mean by go vanilla. Second thing is build the A team. And I think of a three-legged stool model for ERP as very effective. I've seen that in action, and something that I really believe is compelling. A three-legged stool model is have a business leader that's assigned, have an IT leader that's assigned, and then if you're working with a system integrator that can bring in those best practices, the third leg of the stool is a system integrator. Define your work streams as end-to-end. So it's not your functional silos like supply chain versus manufacturing versus IT versus something else. But end to end are things like plan to stock. So if you have a single business leader, it really doesn't matter if that business leader is from manufacturing or supply chain, they should own the entire process end to end from plan to stock, order to cash, hire to retire. So a single business leader, a single IT leader, and a single system integrator leader. Collectively, those three should make the decisions going forward on your business processes and then any implementation decision that comes up throughout the project as well.
Well, once again, good advice. I really like the go vanilla and simplify processes as much as possible. You know, the idea of having lean and effective processes, but there's a balance there, right? You don't want to have your processes be too lean, but you don't want them to be overly complex and sophisticated. So how does readiness for IT and ERP transformation specifically, Jen, impact the success of firms with a significant focus on portfolio expansion?
Well, I think of this as I was part of the SAP implementation, as I mentioned, that we implemented SAP successfully in 33 months. If you kind of think about the fact that we didn't have to do it, we didn't actually have to implement a brand new ERP system. We wanted to do it in terms of future scaling and future growth. And I think of it also as there's never a good time to do a transformation. As in, we're always super busy. Companies are always acquiring. They're always making things more efficient. They always have digital transformation initiatives. They always will have that. Does the change become slower? Or I'm reminded of this quote that, yes, it's been changing faster and more than ever, but it will never be this slow. So the fact that you have mergers and acquisitions shouldn't actually stop you. It should actually prompt you to really consider how you can embark on the journey of digital transformation to build that foundational infrastructure, whether it's processes or system or data, to enable you to do more in the future with your portfolio. So it is a scary and large initiative. It is multi-year, but if you don't embark on that journey, as I mentioned, the example of the product and part SKUs, it actually will become at a point where it will hinder your business process. The product and part SKUs, as an example, if you don't clean that up front and establish the right master data management around that, it will affect your ability to not only price, but also sell and manufacture your product down the road.
Yeah. And I think, Jen, with some of these questions today, I think maybe a common theme with the line of questions that I have for you is being proactive and deliberate, right? And especially when it comes to readiness for IT and ERP transformations, certainly impacts the success. So, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, readiness to me means understanding the purpose, the mission, the values of the change to begin with, and then having a shared definition of success and then the proper change culture to implement that change. And I think I've heard you in multiple responses here today just talk about the idea of, you know, putting in the time, creating the insurance, let's say, on the front end that can pay dividends down the road in terms of, you know, success. So being prepared and ready right out of the gates saves a lot of time, money, and effort and organizational capital later on in the project.
Yes, absolutely. You summarized it perfectly.
So could you talk about the role of PMO in driving ERP success and risk mitigation in large-scale projects? I know I've asked you a couple of questions somewhat related to this, but what role specifically does the PMO have in driving ERP success and mitigating risk? And then maybe if you can give an example of what risk mitigation might look like.
Yes. So I think one of the largest risks of any large-scale initiative like the ERP or any digital transformation is your resource risk. So I actually develop a very simple but effective method to assess the resource impact up front. And what I do with that is imagine a simple grid. You have the months all across the columns, and then the rows are your key resources. You can do those by roles. IT developer, as an example, there might be your architect, there might be QA. Business meets all of the various business areas. Of course, you'll need a project manager or two to enable that. So whatever your roles are, those are the rows on that grid. And then now you're going to start to put in percentages, and you can ramp that up over the months. And then that what that will give you at the end of the day, you can add up all those percentages. So 100% is one FTE as an example. You could do five FTEs, which is 500%. You get the idea. What that will enable you to do is assess what are the in-source impact by months. So a lot of times people don't have that granularity of planning by months, but it is critical to plan by months because you don't want to have a false resource plan where you just say, I need 10 FTEs for the year, when in reality is I need one FTE starting in January and then ramps up to 10 FTE by the time it's June, July. Because what that will also allow us to do is to convert the percentages into a blended rate. So let's just say you use a simple blended rate like $100 an hour. Now you can assess apples to apples comparison around this initiative or this part of the project is going to cost X with this number of resources with this type of role against this other project that will cost X with this number of resources and this number of role. It also allows you to sequence the projects potentially. Not everything has to start in January and end in December. You can actually, because of that ramp, sequence those so that you're staggering some starts and staggering some of those projects or resource loads so that you're intentionally balancing that. Those are powerful things that I think the PMO does if it's effective and can drive that across the organization for resource allocation on an organizational level.
Yeah. Jen, that is great. I agree with you. It seems to me that this idea of FTE management and sequencing is a true skill or experience. Well, I should say it's a true skill that experienced PMs and PMOs have. And some do a better job in that area than another. But I could not agree more that it is absolutely critical idea. You know, one of the things you see, Jen, is, you know, you go in and you have these projects and talking about resource risk. PMOs or PMs, they may go into a project and start allocating stakeholders to specific duties and tasks. and you overwhelm them. So they have their day job to do, which is, you know, in some cases 30, 40, 50 hours a week or plus. And then on top of that, you're asking them to be a participant in a pretty substantial organizational change project. You know, I think there's a lot of great literature that speaks to this topic, and there's some various degrees of thoughts on this, but there is multiple pieces of work, peer-reviewed work that says, hey, if you get over that 15 to 20% of a stakeholder's time being engaged in the new large-scale project, in addition to doing their day job, and you don't make any changes to accommodate that, that creates issues, right? Frustrations and burnout and other issues like that, that I think often PMOs or project managers don't consider as much as they should, again, on the onset of the project.
Yes, absolutely. I think the example that you gave was really hit the nail on the head, which is if you're depending on a resource that already has a day job, and you're going to allocate a percentage of their time, and as you said, hopefully it's not more than 10 or 15%, but a lot of times it will become more than that because of that ramp that I just mentioned. The answer and the solution, if we really do an intentional resource plan up front, is to actually backfill those SMEs so that as a ramp occurs, they're backfilled as a higher temporary resource to maintain that operations. So we talked about operational continuity. Well, that's what this is to backfill those resources so they can actually work on the project and not on maintaining their day job. That's actually really key and critical because most of the risk and issues that are raised by project managers on these large scale initiatives is the fact that resources aren't available when they're needed. Well, do we plan for this and do we communicate the plan and make sure that we have either backfills in place or other resources that are available to do this?
Yeah, you know, M&A, mergers and acquisitions, can often be a time of high change, you know, high expectations, frustrations, and often turnover due to uncertainties. And then now on top of that, you're throwing more responsibilities on various stakeholders with your large scale project, whether it's IT or certainly ERP. Great advice. So, Jen, I really appreciate your time. Before I let you go, I do want to ask you two more questions today. And my next question is, what advice would you offer for leveraging technology to drive organizational change and maintain a competitive edge in the market? So just in general, do you have any advice you can offer up on leveraging technology in a way that can give an organization more of a competitive advantage?
Yes. There's lots of PPM tools out there that can drive the visibility into the strategic execution, which are through projects and programs. And I've even implemented a few of those PPM tools myself. But I will say the key here is that any tool is only as good as the data and the process behind it. And so instead of thinking about which tool or technology to leverage upfront, it's actually the discipline and culture issue that needs to be addressed first. And then the business process in terms of standardization and alignment. And then ultimately, the technology will support that. And it's a lot easier to select a technology to support a well-defined standard business process where the people part of it, because people are needed to input the data that will actually enable the organization to leverage that technology.
Ah, that's great. You know, I say all the time that maintaining transactional discipline. So, you know, so one thing that's a competitive advantage for sure, regardless of the platform you have, is as you just said, is managing the people and processes in the way that you're using your business intelligence, your business systems. And, you know, I say all the time that if you think about it, ERP transactions for the most part represent dollars, right? So whenever there's a transaction in your logical system, your ERP system, and I'm not saying always, but often that either represents the transfer of a dollar or the transformation of a dollar. And so therefore, you want the time in which you physically move product, let's say from the time you do a receipt to the time you do a shipment and everything in between, that physical representation of your business needs to be timely and accurately recorded in your logical representation of your business. And sometimes that's easier said than done. You know, so this idea that you mentioned, I couldn't agree more, of just making sure you develop the processes. And it's not all about functionality within the system and the technology or the specific tech stack that you're using and that sort of thing, although that's critical. but it's a much bigger thing than that. So I appreciate it. All right, Jen, one of my favorite questions here as we wrap up this really insightful conversation, I'd like to ask you for our golden nugget. So given all that we've discussed today, could you briefly summarize for our listeners the key takeaways that they should remember? So what is the single most valuable piece of advice you would offer from your experience and your perspective for our listeners as they navigate their journeys in organizational change and strategic development?
Yes, there's three parts to this. So it's one nugget, but there are three parts. The first is to build accountability into your projects and process and have someone drive that. So it doesn't have to be the PMO, but it has to be someone that's accountable and can hold the other leaders accountable. The second thing is to adopt vanilla for your IT or ERP implementation. Learn the best practices that's already built in the system that you're buying, and then ruthlessly simplify. Don't customize, at least not initially, but really learn to use the new processes that's inherent in the system. The third thing, specifically around mergers and acquisitions, is to address the integration upfront and the integration of the systems and the processes. It's the hardest thing to do, which is why most companies put it off, but it's also the biggest and most important thing to do, because companies regret that when they don't do it upfront. When it was relatively easy, if you look back historically, it was easier at the time of that merger and acquisition versus years later when you run up into a sanction or other issue that is forcing you to do that later. Because businesses only get bigger and more complex as the time goes on.
Yeah, great advice. I really like your phrase, ruthlessly simplify. I think that those are words to live by, that's for sure. Well, listeners, that wraps up another insightful episode. We've covered the essentials of organizational change, PMO's strategic role, IT governance, integration, and the intricacies of M&A. Thanks to Jen's experience, we've gained valuable insights for enhancing strategic operations and driving successful transformations. So apply what we've learned today to advance your projects and organizational goals. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for more expert insights to help you excel in your professional journey. And Jen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate your dedication to your trade. From one practitioner to another and one PM to another, I'm very grateful for your work. But before we go, can you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you?
Yes, it's been delightful talking to you today. Everything I'm passionate about, PMO's digital transformation and strategy. I'm happy to connect on speaking or consulting opportunities for building PMOs, executing digital transformation, or strategic planning. You can follow or connect with me on LinkedIn. My handle is Jen Strategy. So it's linkedin.com/IN/Jen Strategy. I also have a website, which is strategy-pm.com.
Super. Well, thanks, Jen. And we'll definitely, we'll include that information in the show notes as well. Jen, thank you again. Be well, keep in touch, and we will talk soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP, organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag TheERPOCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.